Live from Burbank, California, where I'm proud to say I just finished my MASH spec script. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now, no one wants to look at his package. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Of course, lurking conservatives, pain sponges and need machines. How is everybody out there tonight? Things were not so good today at the South Central Farm. We talked to Daryl Hannah yesterday. Now, whatever you may think about being in a tree and protesting from a tree or standing up for something that is local and seemingly futile or something that is far away from you and your personal concerns, this was a righteous protest. This 14-acre farm in the middle of South Central L.A. provided 350 farmers and their families with enough vegetables and food and flowers and herbs to sustain some of their lives. Apparently, most of them were Latino families. And the bottom line is that today the cops came, the bulldozers came, they pulled Daryl Hannah and John Quigley out of a tree. She was arrested with 39 people. She's in jail being processed. By the time this show is on, I don't know whether she'll be in and out of jail. And they are probably going to plow this farm under for no other reason than a developer felt stilted. Is that the word? Jilted. Gypped by the city of Los Angeles. The city of Los Angeles pulled an eminent domain on this guy's property in order to build some sort of incinerator for the city that never happened. They bought him out of his property. They lowballed him. They had to. And then they sold it back to him, I think is what happened, this guy Ralph Horowitz, and he wanted to make his nut back. And these farmers, these activists, raised about $6 million, and he said that was $10 million short of what he expected to get for the property. They sent him a fruit basket. They sent him flowers. They pleaded with him to at least have a heart and understand what kind of impact this type of natural surrounding can have on a community, let alone what it was providing these families in food. Today, the mayor of this city and Ralph Horowitz got together in response to that basket of flowers and those fruits and sent the bulldozers in and the cops. And protesters chained themselves to trees, to cement drums. They climbed up into trees. And, you know, I know that many of us on the left and certainly those on the right find it humorous when members of our own tribe climb into trees and protest because part of us says, oh, Jesus, could you not be so stereotypical? Could you not literally chain yourself to the tree? Don't hug. Oh, God, everyone's going to see you hugging the tree. Get out of the tree. You're embarrassing us. But you know what? This is what it looks like sometimes. This is what it looks like when human beings are concerned and taking action. This is the only action human beings can take. It's the same with protests. The one thing I always notice about protests is that even before the days when it actually happens more now, before the days where they'd actually cordon off an area where protesters were allowed to protest. Like, yes, you can protest peacefully, just do it 2 miles from the site of what you're protesting in a fenced off area. Anytime you see angry human beings on the street with signs screaming their beliefs, it's very vulnerable, it's difficult to look at, it's frightening, it's off-putting, it's easy to mock, because those feelings are right on the surface. But, you know, that's what angry humans look like. That's what people who feel they've been unjustly served look like. That's what it looks like when people get together and they have had enough. It's easily mocked, just like it's easy to point and laugh at a crying person. But the bottom line is, this is what human beings are made out of. This is the action they have to take sometimes, and there's no reason to be ashamed of it. I don't know what's going to happen with the South Central Farm. I have no idea, but you can go to South Central Farmers.com and get an update on that. I think it is a worthwhile cause. I think that if there is any of it left or there is hope for this thing, that we should go down there and check it out. It's down on 41st Street and Long Beach Avenue. Other stuff in the news today. Let me tell you about the show we have planned first. And I don't understand what happened. I don't understand. You know, Jason Leopold's an ass. Larissa Alexandrovna, I'm not going to write her off yet, but Jason Leopold I'd written off already. Rove has been let off the hook. He is not going to be indicted, according to his lawyers, according to the news. Jason Leopold was on Ed Schultz today saying that he's still going to be indicted. That is crazy denial, lunatic, dope fiend stuff there. And then there are people that are saying, hey, you didn't hear it from Fitzgerald yet. Okay, well, I'll wait it out, but it's looking like Rove's not going to be indicted. And there's certain things that we can't forget. Let me tell you what's going to be on the show first. Peter Beinart, who I don't know if I like, is the author of The Good Fight, Why Liberals and Only Liberals Can Win the War on Terror and Make America Great Again. I'm interested to hear what he has to say. I've seen him on television. Frightens me a little bit. Can't quite tell him apart from them on some points. Sasha Abramski wrote a book called Conned, How Millions Went to Prison, Lost the Vote, and Helped Send George W. Bush to the White House. Interested to talk to him because we had a guest on last week talking about releasing people from prison, releasing people from these sentences, these mandated sentences for small crimes, you know, diminishing the prison population. And it's interesting that his point in his book, in Conned, is that this is done intentionally, that there are states that will take people off the voter rolls forever if they serve any time at all, forever. There are some states that will allow people to vote again after they have paid their debt to humanity or to society, but only after a very complicated bureaucratic struggle. And there are many people that don't even know whether they can vote or not because they were accused of crime. Excuse me. But the thing that he writes is that this is an intentional process. And now, today, where you get this report from the FBI that violent crime is on the rise again in the United States in a percentage that has not been seen in 15 years, what you're seeing is that you have criminal experts, people who are experts in criminology, saying that the reason this is happening is that the federal budget and the state budgets have stopped relying on policing. There was a period in time, it's almost like they're saying they're soft on crime, but what this indicates to me after our conversation with our prison activist last week and after reading this and reading some of Sasha Abramski's book is that the reason they don't do policing anymore is because the jail business is so damn big. Just throw everybody in jail with mandated sentences, and it does a lot to serve not only the Republican agenda, it diminishes democracy, but it serves this prison industry that makes $40 billion a year and buys out these state legislatures. I'm going to be fascinated to talk to him. We also have Jane Hampshire on. She's a blogger, the founding blogger of FireDogLake.com. She is going to be here to talk to us about the yearly cause, the event that took place that we weren't part of, Jim. It took place in Vegas. I guess, you know, why the hell would we be part of it unless we decide to go? I'm not going to sit here and
I don't even know what it is. What are you talking about?
It was this huge blogger convention they had, and, you know, Harry Reid showed up, Joe Wilson showed up, Howard Dean was there, Mark Warner was there, a lot of, you know, Atrios and
that's
and
where radio hosts go to.
Daily Kos was there. Sam Cedar was there.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's not a matter of radio hosting. It's a matter of the new wave of techno-democracy. These guys are, this community might be defining the outcomes and the momentum towards some of these midterm elections and perhaps towards the presidential elections. And we had Kos in here, and I saw him on a Russert show on Meet the Press. Is that it? Or Face the Nation? Which is it? Meet the Press? It's Meet the Press, yeah. With the talkers, the head, yeah, the Sunday shows. And he was very good, very good. Very good political analysis, very good energy and ambition in terms of how the Democrats are going to pull it back together again. Also on the show, an exclusive first interview with Zarqawi's replacement, Abu Hamza al-Mahajir. Mort Mortensen will be here. But quickly, let's talk about Karl Rove. And I think, you know, what we have to address in knowing that this disappointment is upon us, that once again this guy has somehow evaded our ability to go, yes, yes, spank him, hurt him, cut his ears off, smack him in the head, tie him up, do something, the little pig, make him hurt. Once again, he's evaded our ability to get satisfaction from him being punished somehow, and it pisses me off. I mean, the only solace I can find in the fact that he got off is maybe he put the fix in on somebody bigger. I don't even know. I don't even know what the hell is going on with this thing anymore. It is so damn complicated. The bottom line is, why the hell does this guy still have security clearance? That's one of the big questions. Clearly, he did tip Valerie Plame's identity to a number of people. He is guilty of that. He may not have been the first one. He may not have been guilty of perjury, but he did tip classified information to people that weren't supposed to have it. Yet how come it hasn't been addressed why he still has a security clearance? And somebody better address that. Not that it's going to make a crap load of difference. I am so sick of my smoldering anger around this particular fat pig. And I'm so sick of attributing him as being some sort of genius mastermind of all things. And I heard people on the radio today talking about, oh, it's all part of the plan. How could it be part of the, how could it be that complicated? What the hell's going to happen with this? Fitzgerald's got to tell us all what's going on. He just has to tell us what's going on. Because, I mean, it is clear that Rove definitely did play a part in leaking this person's identity. So I want to know that he can't be part of the big game anymore.
He can still be indicted. He can still be indicted. You know, just because they tell him he's not going to be indicted doesn't mean that they might indict.
All right, well, so you're one of those guys, but, you know, that's fine. I mean, you know, if that's the truth.
I'm just holding out the possibility. I mean, a slim possibility, you know.
By indicted by who? By Fitzgerald?
Yes.
So, you're saying that
it's not illegal for a prosecutor to tell somebody that they're not going to be indicted and then indict them.
Yeah, well, that's what Jason Leopold's saying. Jason Leopold is saying that he's still going to be indicted, and the announcement came from Luskin. From Rove's lawyer, that he's been informed that they're not going to be indicted. The paper says he's not going to be indicted, but I'm tired of being jerked around like this. If you want to hold on to hope for Jason Leopold's career and the fact that Karl Rove is going to be indicted, then I'm with you.
I'm counting on his career.
I'd love it if he were indicted, but I'm just tired of being jerked around. We're going to get this guy on the phone after this, Zarqawi's replacement. That should be interesting. Hamza El Muhajir, next.
Survived 52 minutes after his last bomb. Mark Maron.
Yeah, speaking of that, this new guy, what's his name? Abu Hamza al-Muhajir, the replacement of al-Zarqawi, the heir apparent, I guess, said, don't be overcome with joy about killing our sheikh Abu Musab. God bless his soul, because he has left lions behind him. Well, look. As you all know, last week, terrorist leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was killed in a U.S. airstrike. On Monday, al-Qaeda in Iraq announced his replacement, Abu Hamza al-Muhajir. I can't believe it, folks, but we actually have this guy on the phone. This was no easy thing for my booker to get, you know, especially because, you know, we almost had Lawrence Kasdan the other day, you know, to get this guy. You know, this guy's powerful. So welcome to the show, I guess, Abu Hamza al-Muhajir.
Mark, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm a little uncomfortable, actually, giving you the forum, sir.
Okay, that's fair. That's totally understandable. But, you know, I hope to eliminate all the silly bickering and the partisanship and just, you know, bring everybody together.
Silly bickering? I mean, is that really your interpretation
okay,
of what...
Okay, I know where you're going with this.
What?
You want to destroy us. We want to cleanse the earth with the blood of the wicked and death to America and blah, blah, blah. But that doesn't mean we can't act like grown-ups, Mark.
This is crazy. You sound like a politician.
Really?
Well, I mean, more than you sound like a terrorist.
Oh, I hate that word, Mark. Never, ever call me a politician. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm a people person, Mark. I like talking to people.
Why did you come on my show?
I want to put myself out there, you know, just get the message out, spread the word.
What message?
You know, just cleanse the earth with the blood of the wicked, death to America. You know, the same old, same old. But that, and also teamwork, you know, elbow grease, community spirit, Mark.
All right, look. Military experts predicted Abu Ayyab al-Masri would be selected for the job, but it was you. Okay, you're a relative unknown. You got it. Was that weird or what?
You want to talk about taking a trip to Awkward Town? That was horrible. Yeah, I called him up and I said, look, Mas, come on. We both want this same thing here. No hard feelings, right? He was so great about it. We're supposed to go grab a beer next week.
This is a very awkward thing. But, I mean, what do you hope to achieve as a leader?
Oh, jeez. I, you know what? I made a little list, and I, you know, all these goals you want to do. I can't even think of it right now. But I guess off the top of my head, I want to, I want to clean up the website a little bit, make it a little more presentable. Maybe put the message board on there.
Yeah.
You know, anything that we can do to tap into that 18 to 34 year old market, the better. You know, that's a choice market, Mark. You know what I'm talking
about.
And I want to get some decent body mics, you know, so people can actually hear us on our videos for once.
Yeah, you know, the audio is usually pretty bad on those tapes.
I know. It's horrible. It's embarrassing,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Oh, you know what else I want to do?
What?
You know what else? I want to nail down whether it's Al-Q-U-E-D-A or Al-Q-A-I-D-A.
I
can never figure it out.
Yeah, also sometimes I see a Q-A-E. You know,
I haven't seen that. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. Different news outlets spell it out different ways.
I don't even know which one is right. It's crazy.
Oh, no. What's going to happen what would you like to see happen with Al-Qaeda?
Well, let me ask you a question, Mark.
Yeah.
What would you like to see happen with Al-Qaeda?
What would I like to see happen?
Yeah, everybody has a voice here, Mark. Community spirit, that's what I'm talking about.
Well, I think it would be good if you stopped killing people.
Okay, you know, I'm gonna call that the fair suggestion, and I'm going to stick it into the idea bag.
All right, well, you know what? Actually, that's interesting. You're more accessible than I thought you'd be.
Well, what can I say? I put it out there, Mark. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm not going to go run from safe house to safe house like Zarqawi did, you know. And don't, I'm not putting him down. He's a great guy. But I'm just saying that the type of guy I am, you know, I'm going to be out there with the people, you know, my shirt sleeves rolled up, blowing up the breeze.
Let's just get, enough of this crap. Are you currently planning on to attack the United States?
Whoa, look at this guy. Oh, he gets right to the point. I love it, Mark.
It's a legitimate question.
Okay. What am I going to say, Mark? I'm not going to lie, okay? Of course, I would love to kill all the infidels, right? But I don't want to hug the tar baby of trying to comment on it anymore.
Hey, not cool.
What did I say? Did I say tar baby?
Look, we're out of time.
We're
out of time. All right. You get in these situations, it's awkward. But, he seemed like, what am I going to say? He's a good guy? The guy's an evil bastard. He's just trying to doll himself up as somebody.
Sounds like he'd be a good manager, though. Somebody, an agent or something?
Yeah. So, Jim.
Yeah, what?
Jim, buddy.
Sure.
Buddy, what's going on today? You all right?
I'm just PO'd.
Yeah?
Pissed off.
Just pissed off at the world one of those days?
Yeah, everything.
Oh, man.
I'm sick of it. Sick of it all.
I hate when that happens. The whole thing just turns and there's no way out and there's no hope in sight and, everything you do think is going to happen is probably bad and there's no way to even picture the next 10 minutes being good. It's horrible.
Well, now you made me feel lower than I was before. What the hell is the next 10 minutes?
Yeah, the next 10 minutes could be awful. Who the hell knows what's going
to
happen?
I was looking forward to the next 10 minutes.
All right, so let's say next half hour.
I can't do that. 10 minutes, yeah.
10 minutes will be good. We're going to talk to Sasha Abramski about how democracy is being undermined by the prison business. So stay with us.
Now he vows to avenge the death of disco. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. As I said earlier, there's every indication that violent crime is on the rise in the United States. And part of the reason is, I believe, and I think some other crime experts believe that, I don't know if this is a political angle or not, but they say literally the federal government has stopped financing policing as much as they used to, and I think that's because the prison industry has become so powerful and the sentencing has become so extreme that they just assume just throw people into prison for small sentences, for small crimes, for long sentences. I mean, last year the nation's prisons and jails held 2,186,230 prisoners. That's an increase of 56,428 from 2004. It's an increase of 2.6%. 738 per 100,000 of the population was incarcerated last year. That's up. That's up from 725 per 100,000 from the year before. I mean, we often talk about how prisons are packed. Many people are serving time probably they shouldn't be serving. We know that the prison industry is making $40 billion a year. What we don't talk about in specific terms is how the policy of imprisonment and the ever-growing prison population directly affects the foundation of our democracy on an electoral level. Sasha Abramski has done the work in his new book, Conned, How Millions Went to Prison, Lost a Vote, and Helped Send George W. Bush to the White House. He's here with us on the phone now. Welcome, Sasha Abramski.
Thanks for having me on.
You bet. So now, we all remember hearing about, certainly in Florida and in the last two elections, about people being purged from the voter rolls for being criminals. But it is by design in some or all states to keep a certain type of person from voting. Isn't that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically, most states in the country, if you get convicted of a felony while you're in prison or in some cases parole or probation, you lose the right to vote. The thing is, in about a dozen states going into the 2000 election, in addition to temporarily losing the right to vote, when you came out of prison, you came off of parole and probation, you never got your vote back. So in states like Florida, as more and more people accumulate felony records, the end result is this ever-growing body of people who can't vote. Numbers are incredible. In Florida, about 750,000 to 1 million people cannot vote. Most of them living in the community.
And you say that, you know, even in some of these states where it is possible to get your vote back, the process is daunting, it's complicated, and many of these people, I mean, I don't even like going to do jury duty or pay a parking ticket. I can't imagine what it would have to go through to go before a judge, fill out the paperwork to get your vote back, so many people just don't do it.
That's right, and it's actually far more complicated and intimidating than going before a judge. I wrote my book as a travelogue. I went around the country from coast to coast in the run-up to the 2004 election. And it was basically my way of exploring on the ground what disenfranchisement looks like.
Yeah.
And what you see in some states is this extraordinary hindrance to ever getting people's vote back. So in Tennessee, for example, there was this list of regulations that had five different criteria depending on when you were convicted. So you had to know not only the ins and outs of election law once, you had to know the ins and outs of election law five times. In Kentucky, the governor said you had to write him a personal letter explaining why, in your view, you'd been rehabilitated enough to get your vote back. And in Mississippi, which is my favorite, if you've been convicted of a felony and you want to get your vote back, you have to convince your state representative to personally author a bill that by name personally reenfranchises you. That bill then has to pass both houses in the Mississippi legislature, and then it has to get signed by the governor.
Oh, my
God.
So,
not surprisingly, in Mississippi, about 12 people a year get reenfranchised. So, now, the obstacles are extraordinary.
But now, it's fair to say that those states, you know, certainly the southern states, you know, this was a way for these legislatures to guarantee the continuation of slavery and to deny blacks the vote.
Well, certainly, historically, when you look at the reasons for the specific wording of the felon disenfranchisement codes in states like Mississippi and Alabama and Virginia and Florida, they made no bones about it. 100 years ago, this was a part of the Jim Crow package. It was very much seen as being equivalent to the poll tax or the residency requirement or the literacy test. And there was this very clear assumption, A, that they could tailor disenfranchisement so it would mainly affect blacks, and B, there was this other assumption, which we still see playing out today, that blacks are going to be disproportionately arrested and disproportionately fall into the criminal justice system. You see that all around the country today, that for historical reasons, for economic reasons, you see this vastly disproportionate incarceration and felonization of African Americans.
And now I imagine that what it's evolved into is not only racist, but it becomes a class issue as well. That now that there are plenty of whites, Latinos, you know, any number of different people that are of a certain economic class, that they're going to fall into the criminal class much easier than, say, you or I.
That's right. I mean, when I was going around the country, this is largely an African-American issue because so many African-Americans get caught in the criminal justice system. But it's also, as you said, an issue of poverty. So I interviewed plenty of low-income whites, plenty of low-income Latinos, plenty of low-income African-Americans. The common denominator was almost exclusively these were poor people. And they were people who, in many instances, though not all instances, but in many instances, had committed economic crimes. They were crimes that were born out of poverty and alienation. They were crimes oftentimes directly related to drug use that had gone untreated or to mental illness that had gone untreated. What you were saying in the introduction is it's worth repeating. We're putting all of our dollars at the moment into locking people up. We're putting way too few dollars into preemptively stopping them get involved in the criminal justice system. And we're underinvesting in mental health, for example.
Right, and that's directly connected to Republican policy in the fact that I think that most of the criminal, most of the prison business, private prison business, you know, these are Republican entities. They contribute to Republican candidates, and it's just a scheme to funnel taxpayer money.
Well, certainly, there's this notion now of a prison industrial complex, the idea that regardless of whether or not it's good public policy, there are enough vested interests now that
right.
have a stake in building prisons and in getting people to fill those prisons. We now spend over $60 billion a year running our prison system nationally. That's a staggering amount of money.
Now, in terms of legislation, you talk a little bit, like, you know, there was a story in your book, it was probably in the introduction, about that woman who was a teacher that got hung up with this bad guy and got stuck in a situation and got a record, and she can't get her vote back, and the shame of it. And just, I imagine that there are plenty of regular people that were pushed to the edge by, you know, dire circumstances, and now can't get their vote back. What do you think needs to be done? Should prisoners be allowed to vote no matter what? Should it be a state-to-state thing?
I certainly don't think it should be a state-to-state thing, because when you leave it up to the states, you end up with very, very coercive state policies in states like Florida and Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
and that has a ricochet effect on the national political scene,
mm-hmm.
most obviously in Florida in 2000, because it clearly made the difference in the end between Al Gore and George Bush getting elected president.
And this, and these type of people, this class of people, is
proportionally Democrat.
Right. So what now? Where you come from? England.
I come from England. I've been in America 12 years now.
What's their policy?
Well, very few. Most other countries, including England, once people come out of prison, they get their vote back.
Automatically.
And there are many countries now that let people vote while they're in prison. In Israel, in South Africa, in Germany, I believe, and even in parts of the United States, in Maine and Vermont, while you're in prison, you still maintain your political rights. Now, in America, nationally, that's not where the terms of the debate is. There's a lot of public support to mm-hmm. disenfranchise people as a part of their prison sentence or as a part of their probation sentence. What there isn't is national support for permanent disenfranchisement. When you look at opinion poll data on this, very strong majorities nationwide say when people have finished their sentence, as long as they're living law-abiding lives in the community, they should have the vote back. Now, this should be something that is decided nationally. We expect people to pay federal taxes when they come out of prison, when they have jobs. We expect people to obey state and federal laws when they come out of prison. We expect them to behave in all the ways that we expect other citizens to behave, but we're not giving them a vote. And that vote is deprived regardless of whether we're talking about local elections like school board elections, state elections like governor's races, or presidential elections. So it's clearly an issue with national ramifications.
But and just the basic, the ethics of it, that once you have paid your debt to society, that you should be deemed a working member of that society again.
That's right. Now, I talked to a lot of politicians, especially conservative politicians in the Deep South, and they said to me, well, this is a straw man because these guys are so undereducated and ignorant and alienated that they wouldn't vote even if they could, so you're barking up the wrong tree here.
Uh-huh.
Now, I have two objections to that. One of them is it's just factually wrong. I went around the country and I talked to hundreds and hundreds of people, many of whom, though not all, but many of whom were absolutely desperate to vote. And they told me they felt shamed, they felt humiliated, they felt like they'd become an untouchable caste by not being able to vote.
Right.
But the second thing is, if you or I don't vote, nobody says, oh, well, because of that, you should lose your right to vote. That's a private matter between for our own consciences to work
yeah.
out. We have that political right. If we exercise it, well and good. If we don't exercise it, well, maybe we have only ourselves to blame when George Bush is president, but we don't have any penalty attached. But for this group of people, conservative politicians apparently think they have a right to say that unless they're going to exercise their vote, then it's not an issue.
Right. It's interesting how these guys who claim to be against big government use the bureaucracy and this type of these arcane laws to guarantee and protect their power on this level.
That's right. And when you're saying using bureaucracies, that's exactly what it is. There are extremely efficient bureaucratic mechanisms to disenfranchise people when they get felony convictions. There are information flows from courthouses to county election officials that immediately take people off the rolls.
Unbelievable. Our guest,
but what I found is
yes.
there's no information flow the other way to re-enfranchise people. This is deliberate misuse of bureaucracy.
Okay, so now what can people do?
Well, on one level, they can lobby their state legislatures and their federal congresspeople to pass legislation re-enfranchising people.
Yeah.
Now, that's inherently unsatisfactory. I know that when you ask what you can do and I say write a letter, it doesn't really sort of stoke the emotions. It is actually the most effective thing to be done because these laws are only going to be changed by the passage of new laws.
Well, hopefully
they're not
we can
going to be changed by sort of shouting and screaming in the streets.
Well, hopefully we can move towards that if we can just change the nation's legislature in the 2006 election. Sasha Abramski, I appreciate your time. The book is Conned: How Millions Went to Prison, Lost the Vote, and Helped Send George W. Bush to the White House. A lot of great information. Have a good day, sir.
And you too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
We'll be back with Mort Mortensen is going to be here, and I think there's some sadness. Some sadness in the air. I feel it.
He was Heather McCartney's pimp, Mark Maron.
Hey, 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 hey! How do you like that?
Hey, Jerry Lewis?
Yeah, a little bit. Hey, 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 lady! All right. Sometimes I just like to, work out some talent here and there. Throw a little of that around. Huh? Mm-hmm. Hey, we have a caller. Kevin from Hollywood, you're on the air with Mark Maron.
Hey, Mark, it's actually me, John Zach, the NSA guy, has been tapping your phone calls. Hey, I want to do some stand-up clubs in the Midwest. Do you have any contacts at Funny Bones?
I don't.
If you say no, I know you're lying. You called him.
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't know your act, so I can't recommend you to them.
Okay. Well, here's my act. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's great to be here. I almost had a psychic girlfriend.
Whoa. I don't have the time right now, John.
Don't interrupt me, Mark. I memorized the act straight through. If you stop me, I have to start from the beginning. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's great to be here. I almost had a psychic girlfriend, but she left before we met. Anyway, I'm not into sports.
Hey, whoa, wait, that psychic girlfriend thing, you stole that from Stephen Wright.
Yeah. Isn't he great? Hello?
He just doesn't get it. I'm not going to talk to that guy. I'm going to hang up on him every time.
I think he's funny. You ought to give him a chance.
All right. I don't know. Every week, folks, we reflect in our times of sorrow. As we look back on the lives of the recently departed, here now is grief correspondent Mort Mortensen with our weekly remembrance. Oh, man, you're all messed up today.
Oh, jeez. Caleb Hammond.
Yeah.
Caleb Hammond, Jr., map maker.
Yeah.
Caleb D. Hammond, former president of C.S. Hammond & Company, map makers, is dead after a piece of plaque took a wrong turn down a pulmonary artery and crashed into his aorta.
Damn.
It's a map.
Yeah.
Hammond was second only to Rand McNally in producing atlases pinpointing cities, towns, and countries, large and small, all around the world, that our current president would never, ever read nor care about. Mr. Hammond's grandfather, Caleb, started the company over a century ago with nothing more than an X and the word treasure tattooed on a dead sailor's chest.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's true. It's an American dream to happen there. At any one time, more than 100 cartographers might be working for the company, each one ignoring their wives' desperate pleas to look at the map before driving any further.
Yeah.
You used to have a bit like that.
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't have that bit.
In 1999, the company was sold to Langenscheidt Publishers, a German company that originally made its fortune selling World War II vets travel guides to Argentina.
There you go. Here you go, Mr. Eichmann.
Eichmann?
Yeah.
Thanks for the reference.
Yeah, sure.
Hammond requested his body be folded up like an accordion and crammed into the glove compartment of his family station wagon.
I bet you he wouldn't be folded properly, if it was like my car growing up.
That's right.
Yeah.
He'd folded improperly and just shoved in there with a flashlight.
Yeah.
And that first aid kit.
Yeah.
And the
insurance card.
Old insurance card, the one that's outdated?
Yeah. That's what
the empty beer can?
Exactly.
Right.
So maybe it's...
Okay, just get me going with this.
Yeah.
Flora Jacobs world's authority on dollhouses.
Oh.
Laura Jacobs, the internationally recognized authority on dollhouses and miniature furniture, died last month when a giant cat jammed its paw through her bedroom window and chewed on her for 20 minutes before losing interest and walking up.
Left her there flopping around, probably.
Yeah, but, you know, cats are. It's just, God, man, they're annoying,
awful.
Don't you think?
That's awful.
They really, geez, yeah. What, wait, I love them, though.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Jacobs founded the now famous Washington Dolls House and Toy Museum back in 1975, starting with nothing more than a big dream and a tiny library of law books abandoned by the Nixon administration.
A little political joke in there.
I always got jam one in there somewhere. In his heyday, her museum attracted more than 20,000 visitors a year, most of them concerned psychiatrists.
Yeah.
Jacobs had to close the museum down in 2004 after Michael Jackson kept sleeping with the residents of her miniature Ronald McDonald house.
Oh, a little teeny weeny.
Boys.
Boys, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's good stuff.
Jacob,
if you picture it, it's really funny.
Little Ronald McDonald house and Michael Jackson just rubbing it up against it.
The whole house. Sticking it right in the window.
Right.
And the little boys inside going, oh my God, what is that?
It's Michael Jackson.
Oh, he's here again.
And then Michael Jackson saying in a higher voice,
Hi, boys. Yeah. Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get on.
Jacobs requested her body be placed inside a real size coffin. Seriously, enough is enough already. This has been the weekly remembrance, Mark. Till next week, this is Martin Mortensen saying. So what's up?
Yeah. What's up, buddy?
Oh God.
Oh man,
you got something too.
I'm a little choked up, yeah. I got some problems. Thank you, Mort.
Yeah, hey, welcome.
Send Jim back in when you see him. I bet you this excited you, Jim, that Stephen Hawking says we got to go. It's time to leave.
Yeah, space stations and stuff?
Yeah, he says survival of the human race depends on its ability to find new homes elsewhere in the universe because there's an increasing risk that a disaster will destroy Earth. Stephen Hawking, get off, man. We got to go. We got to go.
I'm with him, man.
Oh, he says we won't find any place as nice as Earth unless we go to another star system. All right, no problem. Maybe you should just, you know, make us a map and build us a vehicle that'll take us there and give us a plan. It's pretty grim stuff, though, when he puts it like this. This is a quote from Stephen Hawking. It is important for the human race to spread out into space for survival of the species. Life on Earth is at ever-increasing risk of being wiped out by a disaster such as sudden global warming, nuclear war, a genetically engineered virus, or other dangers we have not yet thought of. End quote.
Well,
he's letting us off the hook there because you know he's thought of them. That's all the guy does think. He just thinks.
Well, what makes him think we won't transport it to another solar system? All that crap.
Oh, Mr. Happy.
Well, if we invent
Holy crap
here, then we're just going to take it to Pluto or
Well, maybe we should
Jupiter,
all just kill ourselves.
Or Hawkinsville or wherever
we do
the
that?
Hell we're
just kill
go
ourselves?
To. The Hawkins. Welcome to my solar system.
Should we just end it for everybody? I mean, what the hell are we saying? I don't know if I'm ready to go. I'm not ready for the trip. I don't like travel. And to travel to another star system, that's got to be a hell of a long flight.
Well, if we did travel there,
man.
This soundtrack would be behind it.
All right, Jane Hampshire from FireDogLake.com is up next.
Ripped from the Deadlines, Mort Mortensen's Weekly Remembrance, next.
He's reveling in his celebrity status, Marc Maron.
Yeah, I'm big time. Not as big as our next guest, I'll tell you that, in terms of celebrity status. Jane Hampshire is the founder of FireDogLake.com. She also contributes to the Huffington Post, Alternet, and the American Prospect. She's the author of the best-selling book Killer Instinct, and she's a film producer. She produced Natural Born Killers and Permanent Midnight about my buddy Jerry Stahl. She splits her time between Los Angeles and up there on the Oregon coast. Sounds like a very nice life, but there's no rest for Jane Hampshire. She's with us on the phone. Welcome to the show, Jane.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be here.
It's nice. Are you up in Oregon now?
I actually am in Oregon right
now.
Straight off of Vegas. I'm recuperating.
Oh, you're so lucky. Oregon's so nice.
It's very beautiful.
So you were just in Vegas at the big blog fest, Yearly Cause. So how was it? Was it a monumental event. Nothing like this has ever happened before.
It was Woodstock for nerds.
Now, what impressed you the most about the blog community?
How intelligent it was. You know, I've been to other conventions before where there's definitely a split between those that are in and those that are out, the people that are, the power structure and the
uh-huh.
people who attend. But it was a very flat, very level conference. You could just wander around, talk to everybody. There seemed to be very little separation on that front.
You
had a really good spirit.
Are you telling me there was no cattiness? I was on your blog yesterday. It didn't sound like Juan Cat was being treated very well.
You know, I would say the journalists and the politicians retreated into some dark corner someplace.
Okay.
Never really showed their faces. I never saw them. I saw Marcos everywhere.
Sure.
I saw Duncan everywhere.
Uh-huh.
Sitting down with people, talking with them, out in the crowd. That's what I did. And I never saw those people. They never emerged. So.
I talked to Marcos here on my show. He was here with Duncan, and I saw him on Russert's show on Sunday, and man, did he handle himself well.
He is so good.
He really was.
He was such a great emissary for everything about the blogs, and I think as Digby said, people are starting to realize that the blogs and talk radio are the voice of democratic politics in this country.
So after seeing a couple of the Democratic presidential hopefuls there in Vegas, what do you think? Anything? Warner? Anything?
I didn't actually spend any time with them. I was more interested in talking to the readers.
Uh-huh.
So I'm gonna duck that question.
Okay, all right.
I'm really not knowledgeable.
Well, were you around when Harry Reid had that powwow with the bloggers and talked pretty candidly about the blogger community's movement to de-seat Al Lieberman?
I think I was the one he talked to about that. And, yeah, I Matt Stoller double dog dared me to go up and ask him about Lieberman, and I did. And, yes, it was quite surprising how candidly he spoke about
Joe Lieberman. I don't know why.
I came prepared for the question.
I called him Al Lieberman. I don't know why. Joe Lieberman.
Lieberman.
So what did Reed have to say about that?
Well, I asked him, what are you going to do about Joe's committee appointments? Because the rumor keeps circulating that Joe's going to jump the party.
Huh.
And if that does, Harry Reid, as the minority leader, would rightfully strip Joe of those appointments.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of dodged that. Well, we don't know, because there is a question about who Lieberman would caucus with. And the last thing they want is for him to, go caucus with the Republicans.
Right.
So I do understand that Harry Reid's in a bit of a spot. And yet, it's not okay to reward people for leaving the Democratic Party by giving them powerful committee chairman, committee memberships.
Well, it's interesting. Even watching Marcos deal with this schism within the Democratic Party in terms of these moderates and these centrists, sort of paying bad lip service to what they're calling liberal fundamentalists, who are, I see most of the time are Democrats who respect the core values of what the Democratic Party is supposed to stand for and not willing to compromise. How do you feel about that?
I don't see it as a schism between liberal fundamentalists and the
centrist
kind of, solid, sensible citizens they like to portray themselves as.
Right.
I see it as a schism between people who believe that being a Democrat actually means something and those that are willing to compromise anything to keep power.
And those are the ones that ultimately look like they have no vision.
They're the ones that are killing the party. People,
right.
There was a poll recently released that said that the faith in Republicans is tanking, but you would expect that faith in Democrats would be going up. And it isn't. It's holding steady. So people are just cynical. They're looking over and saying Democrats don't stand for anything. And I think these people are, as you say, the people who are creating that image.
Right. I agree with you. I would like to see more Democrats with vision and a certain amount of spunk and commitment reveal themselves.
I agree. And I will say about Mark Warner, I didn't see him speak. But from what I talked, from what I heard from people afterwards, the general sense was, They weren't getting a sense that he was really very committed to anything. They kind of were walking around going, well, what does he stand for? And nobody was really providing an answer to that question.
It's very interesting. Guys at the point that he's at in his career, people like even like Barack Obama in the Senate, they come out blazing, and then all of a sudden they're kind of waiting it out to see which way to work it.
Yeah, which way the wind blows.
Exactly.
It doesn't inspire confidence.
That's for sure. So now, I know a pet interest of yours is Karl Rove, and you must have been surprised today, huh?
Not really.
Really?
I was just actually writing on my blog that, you know, one of the things that I did when I was at Yearly Coast was host a plane panel that I'm so proud of. And if anybody gets a chance to see it on C-SPAN, I believe it's over there right now, and you can view it. And, you know, the panel was me, Larry Johnson, Joe Wilson, Dan Frumkin, Murray Wass, Christy Harden-Smith, and Marcy Wheeler, Empty Wheel from the last hurrah. And it was just such a smart group of people talking about this subject in a way that you just don't see on television.
Uh-huh.
You know, the cable news treats Cato Byrne like her opinion on this subject matters, like Tony Blankley somehow should be on, you know,
right,
talking about this. And it was a really wonderful, well-informed panel, and we got to have a lot of conversations. And at the time, last Thursday, both Joe Wilson and Larry Johnson expressed the opinion that they thought Karl Rove had flipped. And Christy, who is a former prosecutor, said that she thought that it was very unusual for somebody to testify five times before a grand jury and not be cooperating in some fashion with a special prosecutor.
Okay, so let's say that's true, Jane Hampshire from FiredDogLake.com. Let's say he flipped. What is he giving them? Is he going to give him Cheney? Is he going to give him more dirt on Libby? I mean, what does he have to offer in the plain case?
Well, the wonderful thing about Patrick Fitzgerald is that he doesn't say anything about this, unlike Ken Starr.
I find it unnerving. I'd like to know right now.
Well, yeah, I know it's unnerving to you, but the great thing is it's unnerving to the administration, and that's why they keep making one bad blunder after another, I think.
Uh-huh.
They don't know where they're at with this. So I think it's been a very successful tactic for Fitzgerald, even if we have to stay in the dark a little bit, and it is the right thing to do.
So let's speculate. What do you think? What did he flip? What did he give him?
I believe it's all about Cheney, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that document that Fitzgerald put out in the Joe Wilson article that Cheney annotated.
Uh-huh. Right,
I think
right.
Is the blue dress in this particular
no
situation.
Kidding.
Yeah, I think that really does indicate that he is behind all of this, and I think that's who Fitzgerald is gunning for. Now, whether Rove is giving him more to convict Libby with, and then he hopes to flip Libby on Cheney, that's a possibility, or Rove may be giving him something on Cheney. I don't know, one or the other, but I just don't believe that this particular prosecutor got nothing for something.
It's so fascinating. Even in my head, you sort of see Cheney as a dark, evil figure beyond reproach unless he agrees to it.
Yes.
It's a fascinating thing. The thought of him coming down is a great thought. I just don't know what it's going to look like. I imagine if it does happen, they're going to try and spin it into a great thing right before the midterms and throw somebody like Chuck Hagel in there, who I don't know who the hell would be vice president. Who do you think would be?
I think Hagel's probably as good a choice as any. You know, somebody, Marcy Wheeler, was speculating today that this might be very well be a good way for Rove to get Cheney out of there. I mean, you can't just ask him to leave. So putting him under the legal spotlight might be you know, a very effective way of getting rid of your problem, blaming him for Iraq, blaming him for a whole host of problems.
Right, but and asking him first and saying, look, are you willing to eat this and go back to Wyoming and just you know feed on young children or whatever it is that you do in your free time?
Yeah, yeah. Virgin's blood.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so before we finish up here, what brought you to this? Obviously, you had a great career, and you probably still do in film production. What brought you to blogging?
I just got very excited about the energy of it. You know,
mm-hmm.
there's just something about it. It's like punk rock in the 70s. That seems to be where all the cultural energy is right now. It's where the smart people are going. It's where all the creative possibilities are right now. I mean, movie business is fun, but it's not as lively. It just doesn't have the you know, it's calcified in a lot of ways. And blogging is just really exciting, and I just started doing it for the fun of it, and the next thing I knew, 100,000 people a day were showing up.
Well, I'll tell you, the two movies that you're known for are certainly edgy films, so you are definitely attracted to the rock and roll element.
Well, it's a lot of fun, and yeah, it is very rock and roll right now. They're great people in the blogosphere. I mean, something's happening. Something's changing. We're hitting a tipping point.
We're
coming out of the Republic of Gilead. We've been in for several years, I think, and it's very exciting to be a part of that, and I think the Yearly Coast Convention really demonstrated the energy that's there on this front.
Awesome, Jane Hampshire. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
I enjoy your
Mark.
Blog. You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. FiredogLake.com is her blog. It's good stuff. A lot of good people blogging there. It's nice looking. There's things to do. You know, it's a nice afternoon.
That ended on a positive note.
No, I enjoy talking to her. I hope she wants to talk to us again. So we will be back. We've got Peter Beinart, who I'm a little... I don't know how that's going to pan out. We'll be back in a second.
out he's creeping higher than wholesale prices. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim.
Hey, look.
Hey, hold on. Well, yeah, I got to reach down and grab this. See, I'm off mic now. I'm
going. He's reaching down and he's grabbing this.
I throw my papers on the floor. That's how I do it. I throw them all on the floor as I use them, but clearly I needed to use this one again.
Texture.
For later. It's all texture. Is that's a word I use. Did you take that from me, or is that something
I'm
mocking
you with it right now.
Texture. Oh, I thought you were honoring the word texture.
No, I never.
Texture. Ah!
Meta.
Ah!
Meta.
Ah!
Texture.
How's that for texture?
No, that's good.
Do you like
that? That, you know.
Why didn't you help me? You saw I was in trouble.
Acting course?
Why didn't you help me?
Help
you
with
what? I was in trouble.
What, you want me to give you a Heimlich?
I was screaming. What, do I have to say help for you to understand that I'm having a problem? I'm screaming over here, testing our friendship.
Okay, well, you scream a lot.
I don't scream like that.
It's hard for me to tell, you know, what scream is what.
I was having a hard time there.
You're like a cat. It's hard to tell what meows mean. Hey,
I didn't
how
know,
you doing?
I had no idea whether or not I was going to get through what I just went through. Do you know what I just went through in my head?
What happened?
No, forget it. Thanks.
Well, no, go ahead.
No, thanks for helping out.
I don't
know
what goes on in your head.
Let's take this call. I think it's Willie from Los Angeles. You're on the air with Mark Maron.
It's actually me, John Zach, the NSA guy. Has been tapping your phone calls.
Yeah.
Hey, how did you meet your wife? You never talk about that on the phone.
Why do you need to know this?
Well, I want to meet a woman exactly the same way you did. So anyway, what was the deal?
I met her at a comedy club, at the Comedy Cellar.
Uh-huh. And what's the first thing you said?
Look, if you try to replay a scene from someone else's life, I just don't think it's going to work, John.
Oh, yeah, well, sometimes I recreate our entire phone conversations with my own friends.
Uh-huh, and what happens?
I find out they're not my real friends, Mark.
I've got to go.
Mark, you got to help me out.
I can't take it anymore with this guy. I can't, you know, I've got other problems, man.
Help him.
Why can't, you know, we can't get any closure on Rove.
Help him.
The president is in Iraq telling them that everything's going to be great. They're going to have a government by the people, for the people, of the people, the whole bit of business. He can't even give a speech here that people will find credible. He's got to go over there looking for friends. I wonder what his approval rating is in Iraq right now. And I'm sitting there watching myself in the mirror age like Jeff Goldblum in The Fly. I'm surprised I'm not pulling pieces of myself off. Oh, my God. I can't believe that's happening.
Is that your phone?
Yeah, I choose the Middle Eastern theme.
My God.
Hey, man.
Jesus, I can't believe this is happening.
It's great. It's great. This is improvisational radio. Hold on a minute. Hold on. Hello? Oh, wait. Hello? Hey, I'm on the air right now, baby. And I can't talk to you right now because we can't hear the other end of the conversation. It's not fair to the people that are listening. But okay, Mishna says she loves you. I think they enjoyed the ringtone though. But I gotta finish the show. I'll call you right back. Bye.
Thank you for doing the other side of that conversation.
That was exciting. That because that happens to normal people, and I think it's important that people know that I'm normal. What was I talking about? Oh, myself. Hey, I think that my
eyes glaze over. Yourself?
Let me just ask you a personal question. I think we've covered a lot of important topics already.
Yes, I like you.
No. That, if I cared about that, man. Whew. Boy, Jesus.
All right, you do care about it.
Are you finding as you get older that your nose is growing larger? I'm serious.
Everybody's nose grows larger when they get older.
I'd heard that. I'd heard that, but I didn't want to notice it. Do you understand? I didn't want to notice it. I did not want to look at myself in the mirror and say, it's happening. I knew there was a day that I would not be able to keep my six-pack anymore. You know, I knew there was a day where, you know, my tremendous Adonis-like physique would start deteriorating a bit and there'd be nothing I could do to control it. But I did not anticipate the growing of the nose.
Your nose is not getting larger. It's just that your penis is getting smaller. In relation, it looks like your nose is getting larger.
That's the other thing I wanted to talk to you about.
Oh, it's, man, not again.
It's huge. I don't even know what to do with it anymore. I had to get my shorts fixed. Both of them are growing, the ears, the nose, and the penis. I'm not bragging either. You know, I'm sorry if you're having a different experience with
bad
yours.
Bad news for you, that's cancer.
It is?
Yes.
Well, man.
That old joke.
I'm not going to tell my wife.
Doctor, my penis is twice as large as it used to be.
Yeah, and what's the joke?
It's cancer.
And that's the end of it?
Yeah, that's pretty much. That's a funny ending to a joke, cancer. You with me? What?
Jim, I wish you would get help. You know, I really do. Because I don't know how you can go through life, you know, as you are, without realizing that you have deep, horrible problems that you have to reckon with.
I wish I could reckon. I don't even know what reckon means. What is this, like 19th century America? What are we in, Wyoming?
You Whoa. Better reckon with your deep psychological problems there, Burton.
I'll remember that next time you do one of your, you know, ornately hyper-worded bits that uses medieval vernacular. I'll be sure to make note of this conversation,
sure.
Mr. Condescendo.
Blustery huh? blowhard.
Are you
like
the superhero? Condescendo?
One to talk about me with my hyper vernacular, ornate speech patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Rambling, hey, this is what's on my mind. It's on yours now. It's on. You know.
I'm sorry, I have the gift of talking. Whereas you can only write it down, it takes you hours. What does it take you, 9 hours to write one of those bits to make it sound like you're talking? I can just do it. I know it's jealous, you're jealous, and it's part of the reason why you have a hard time socially. I understand that. You all right?
You're absolutely
right.
Come on, right.
Bring it! Bring it!
Absolutely right.
I know I'm right.
I'm really... what the hell are you talking about?
I love you, man. Hey, in just a second... Boy, that was a very exciting segment.
Damn, Rove.
Dude, we're going to talk to somebody that turned down a Rhodes Scholarship. Turned down a Rhodes Scholarship. You want to talk about real intelligence, I'm just a rambler. You know, I'm just a BS guy. This guy's got the goods, and I don't understand any of it. You know what? It makes me resent him. And I hope this interview goes well. It's Peter Beinart, and the book is How Liberals Are Going to Win Something Back and Do a Thing. No, here, I'll tell you what it is, exactly. It's The Good Fight, Why Liberals and Only Liberals Can Win the War on Terror and Make America Great Again. This ought to be good.
Now he's greenlit. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Let's get into this. Peter Beinart is the editor-at-large of the New Republic magazine. He graduated from Yale University. He won both Rhodes and Marshall scholarships, and he declined the Rhodes scholarships. It would have made him part of that secret special club that runs the world. And he chose not to do that, Jim. He graduated from University College, Oxford, in the summer of 1995 with a Master's of Philosophy degree in International Relations. In other words, Jim, he's a smart guy. He's written for the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, Time Magazine. His new book is The Good Fight, Why Liberals and Only Liberals Can Win the War on Terror and Make America Great Again. He's on the phone with us now. Welcome to the show, Peter Beinart.
My pleasure.
Now, you make some distinctions in your book based on history between modern and arcane definitions of liberal. Could you define liberal as you think it should be defined to me, please?
Sure. You know, in domestic policy, the notion comes from Franklin Roosevelt.
Okay.
It's basically the idea that government steps in to solve problems in society too large for individuals to solve alone.
Mm-hmm.
And in foreign policy, in a way, it's kind of an extension of that. I think the core of the liberal idea about foreign policy is that there are problems in the world too big for America to solve alone. And the way America leads is by bringing other countries together to solve those problems, first and foremost by living up to the ideals that we preach to others, by making ourselves a model for how the rest of the world should act.
Okay, now let me just... Okay, so there's a historical definition of, on a political level, on a policy level, what liberal means. What has it come to mean in terms of where we stand now? Because I didn't know that's what liberal meant, and I consider myself a liberal. Where is the schism there?
It's funny, you know, in the 40s and 50s, conservatives were calling themselves liberals. They were fighting over that term, but starting in the 60s, they started to demonize the term, and that's continued all the way up until today. So what they kind of argued was that liberalism really meant license. It meant basically no rules or limits on human behavior at all, kind of the counterculture gone wild, no moral standards for the world, believing that dictators could do whatever they wanted, no willingness to draw distinctions between responsible and irresponsible behavior. That's what they've argued liberalism means, but that's really not what liberalism means at all.
Now, in what you were saying, though, I have to imagine that the New Deal liberals that you were talking about, it seems to me that, in my recollection, many of liberals of that time were bordering on communist and socialist ideologies, and there must have been a separation between what you were talking about and those people, right?
Actually, actually, you know, what liberals always recognized was that the only way to prevent communism from taking hold in the United States was to reform capitalism. What liberals always said was that they were the best friends of capitalism because they recognized that unless capitalism's inequities were tempered by government intervention, unless capitalism were made more fair, less brutal, and less unstable, that in fact our capitalist system would fall. Liberals have always argued, and should today, that it's really conservatives who are the great friends of revolutionaries, because conservatives are the ones who make people so desperate that in fact they give up on the system entirely. But liberalism has always been about reform. It's about democratic capitalism, capitalism in which the democratic system regulates capitalism, but rather than business dominating the democratic system.
So that's that you in talking about how conservative policy, you know, makes people give up. You're talking about many of the effects of globalization and deregulation and privatization.
Well, and particularly, you know, some of those things the United States can't do very much about, but certainly it's the role of the United States government to try to equip its citizens as much as possible, I think is what Bill Clinton tried to do, so that they can survive and compete and flourish in these world. This means giving them access, better access to health care, to child care, to pensions that will stay with them even as they go from job to job, which is the reality in this new world. What conservatives want to do is basically make the economy more and more and more risky and insecure for people, because they basically believe that the more risky life is, the more responsible people will be. The basic conservative idea is if people know that there's no safety net to catch them if they fall, then they will become virtuous. That's the way of inculcating virtue in the citizenry. But in fact, historically, that hasn't been the case at all, and it's a very brutal way of thinking about the way society works.
Well, that's crazy. That to me is an equation for freak-outness.
Well, you know, the conservative argument is, you know, one of the classic conservative arguments has been if you have seatbelts or something like that, then people will not take responsibility for themselves in order to make sure that they drive responsibly. That's the, you know, if you have unemployment insurance, then people won't act responsibly and keep their jobs. That's a very deeply embedded conservative idea about how you inculcate virtue in society. But I think it's actually empirically wrong and morally indefensible.
It's empirically wrong, and I think statistically wrong in that you know, if you do it right and you regulate these things properly, they do end up helping people through hard times and maybe getting them in the right direction.
That's exactly right. And the argument that I make about liberalism, I make this in my book, The Good Fight, which is that actually it's liberals it's only in the liberal vision that people can really be risk takers. We think of ourselves as a society of risk takers, and we are, and that's great. But people can't take risks unless they know that there's some safety net underneath them. If you don't have health care when you leave your job, you're going to stay in a dead-end job rather than go and get some more education to try to get a better job, because you'll be afraid of losing your health care. Conservatives talk about how they make people more free by reducing the size of government, but the right kind of government intervention actually makes people more free to take risks, because unless you have a good education, unless you know you have health care, you don't take a risk. And it's ultimately, it's risk-taking that has been at the center of America's success.
And also, the conservatives that we have in the administration now have bloated the government, so the bureaucracy protects the wealthy and disables people who are striving or want to take risks to better themselves.
That's right. I mean, truly honest conservatives, I think, are actually kind of appalled by the way that K Street has entangled itself with big government. Because what K Street wants is not no interference from government at all. What they want is special privileges from government, advantages for their industries over other industries, advantages for their industries over other parts of society. And an honest conservative would say, you want no part of that. And some conservative intellectuals do say that, but the reality of what Republican control in Washington has become is something very different.
Well, we're talking to Peter Beinart, The Good Fight, Why Liberals and Only Liberals Can Win the War on Terror and Make America Great Again, is his new book. So let's move to the war on terror, because I know that I've read that you were for the war in Iraq initially. You have since changed your mind, but you see that liberals need to approach the idea of terrorism as something akin to totalitarianism in order to define themselves as historical liberals again.
Well, I do argue in the book that I think jihadism is a totalitarian movement. What I mean by that people define totalitarianism in the 1940s, basically a movement that has a vision of society in which the state crushes all independent civil society organizations with the ultimate vision of purifying society and purifying human nature to try to create this perfect human being that can create this messianic vision of society. That was really behind Nazism and communism. And I think if you look at the writings of the people who've influenced Bin Laden and Zarqawi, that idea comes through very strongly. And we have this very rich anti-totalitarian tradition as liberals. The recognition that, in fact, the way we defeat those visions of society is by making America a better society. One of the reasons we defeated communism in the 40s and 50s and 60s was not just because we preached to the world about how great a democracy we were, as George W. Bush did, but we struggled to become a freer, better society ourselves by promoting civil rights, for instance, by showing that we weren't just going to rest on our laurels as better than the Soviet Union. We were going to show the world an example of what a free society could do if it struggled against its own injustice. And that's really what we haven't been doing since 9/11.
Well, it's been difficult because the deck has been stacked with Republicans.
Well, yeah, and one of the arguments that I make in the book is that Republicans, conservatives since the 50s, and I try to trace the story, have had this tremendous fear that Americans don't believe strongly enough in themselves, that we're weak of will, and that's led them to reject any suggestion that we're not living up to our own standards, because for them, they think that leads America to stop believing in themselves. But the liberal argument is, in fact, that what makes Americans believe in themselves is that process of becoming a better society, of struggling, not being complacent about ourselves today. And, you know, today, in a globalized world where people around the world can see what we're doing in Guantanamo Bay and these anti-terrorist prison camps, and they see the hypocrisy of the words that we preach to others and the things we practice at home, the best way of reestablishing American legitimacy so we can actually promote democracy in the Middle East, which I think we need to do. We need to stand with these people who are struggling for freedom. The only way we can actually do that is by starting to live up to those ideals in our own actions.
Well, let me ask you, let's just talk about the war in Iraq, you know, right now. And also, I think there's an issue in terms of really, you know, making Americans understand, because I have not heard jihadism characterized as totalitarianism really as succinctly as you just put it, too much in the press, that's for sure. And I know that, you know, Christopher Hitchens, who was once someone who you would not have thought would have supported the Iraqi war, has supported it for similar reasons, in the sense that he is able to define Saddam Hussein as a fascist and that any excuse to kill fascists is a good excuse. And I still see this war as being a quagmire, as being a disaster, as being a training ground for terrorism. And I still don't hear the language that you're speaking coming out of anybody other than you.
Well, I to go back to Iraq, you know, I did support the Iraq War, and I say in the book I try to wrestle with my support for it and say why I think I got it wrong. And there are reasons for that. I think I assumed that Saddam had a nuclear weapons program, but by the March of 2003, when we went to war, there was more and more evidence that he didn't have one, and I failed to notice that. Look, Saddam was a hideous, hideous leader, and we should all celebrate his downfall. But one of the lessons of the Iraq War is that there are limits to America's capacity around the world, particularly when we're acting basically alone, when we don't have the legitimacy that comes with being a part of a group of other countries. That one of the reasons we had so much trouble convincing the Iraqis that we were really there to help them was because they saw how illegitimate the war was in the rest of the world. I think I was not sufficiently aware of that. I didn't think about that enough in the days before the war. But now, I would say, now that we're there, I do think America has an obligation to that society. You know, we turned it upside down. We went in there. They didn't ask us to invade. We turned the country completely upside down. We told these people, you got to go vote and elect a government. And they risked their lives to vote. They now have this government, and the government's trying to bring the different communities together. And it seems to me, if that government says, we need to stay a while longer because that's our only chance of survival, and if that government collapses, you can just forget about Iraq. I think we have an obligation. I think it's a question
okay.
of national honor.
Okay, all right, I understand that. Well, I guess what I'm not hearing from you is that it doesn't seem that this would necessarily, what you're talking about, be Democrat. It could be Republican. I don't hear progressive values being spoken of.
This is progressive values, absolutely. You know, much more our values than Dick Cheney's values. You know, think of what life is like for gays and lesbians in societies where this Islamist jihadist ideology is taking control. Think of, you know, for women who want to live their own lives.
It's like that here for some of these people.
Sorry?
It's like that here for some gays and lesbians.
It is, and yet it's so much worse, you know, in places like Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, Afghanistan, under the Taliban. These are our people. These are our allies. We need to stand up for them.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time, Peter. I appreciate it. I'm going to have to parse your book carefully. There's a lot of material in it, and it was nice talking to you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Okay, you take care. The book is The Good Fight, Why Liberals and Only Liberals Can Win the War on Terror and Make America Great Again. It's weird because I just sit here and going, where does veganism fit into this? I'm not sure I understand where being a Wiccan is part of what you're talking about. That's not in there because that's not what he's talking about. I'm retarded. We'll be back with what do we got? We can get some closing statements and
short
things.
Order news.
We never did the short order news. Once we're gonna that's interesting. It's just at the end of the show again. All right.
SO news.
All right. Here we go.
Hear that baby crying? Is the house on fire? Who cares? Because right after this break, Mark's gonna read his short order news. So sit down and shut up.
He's a good mother. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Jim. Sorry, I'm on the mic, and now I'm over here. Hey, here I go. Hey,
You know what that is?
What?
Texture.
Hey, here we're coming back. We're coming back in there. Oh, there we are. Look at that. Oh, I'm floating away. Oh, wait. Hold on. This is crazy, Grandpa. We shouldn't have eaten that Willy Wonka stuff. All right. Look, we have a caller. Sharon from Long Beach. You're on the air with Mark Maron.
Hey, Mark, it's actually me, John Zach. The NSA guy has been tapping your phone calls. Quick question, what kind of liability insurance do you have on your house? I could look it up, but I wonder if you knew it offhand.
Why do you need to know that?
Oh, I'm refinancing your mortgage. I can cut it by half a point if we move fast.
You know what? I want you out of my personal business, John.
Well, pardon me for caring about you and gaining power of attorney over you without your knowledge and calling a series of mortgage brokers pretending to be you and threatening a couple of them because they didn't show you the proper respect.
Can I talk to the NSA and get a different spy here?
By the way, you've got a dental appointment Thursday.
I got to go.
And Mark, you've got to...
I can't stand it. I can't... Enough with that. You know, he's as bad as my stalker used to be.
He's trying to help you, Mark.
You remember my stalker?
Yeah.
Oh, I wonder how that guy's doing. Huh? Tom Johnson? I wonder how Tom Johnson's doing. You remember old Tom Johnson?
Don't ask me that.
Do you know?
Sure. Yeah, I know. Yes, of course I know how he's doing.
Is he all right?
Oh, God.
Have you talked to him lately? You have?
No, but in my mind, I know what's going on.
Yeah, I'm sure. It can't be good. And maybe he's doing all right. He's writing for Geraldo's show. Look, folks, I don't care what anybody says. Al Gore is running for president. He's running for president.
Yay!
Yes. Yeah, I mean, let's stop playing around. There's two things going on. Is Rove going to be indicted? And you say maybe he's still going to be indicted. Is Al Gore going to run? Is he not going to run? Tipper Gore said, quote, "If he were going to run in the future, of course I would support him. I think he'd be a fantastic president. He already got a majority of votes of people in this country once, and so that says something," end quote. And then she says, "I can't say yes, I can't say no. Look, he's going to run for president." The wife basically said it. When the wife says something like that, you know that she's on board with it. So if he's at all going, "I don't know, honey, should I do it or should I not do it?" Tipper's like, "I think he should. Come on." She's all excited that he's a movie star. So they're getting all, they you know what? It's interesting. Out of all of them, I can picture them having sex easier than the Clintons or anybody else. George Bush, I can't even imagine. I don't think he has genitals. I think that he takes his pants off and there's just an awkward patch of hair there.
I think he has sex a lot.
I don't know, man.
With Barbara.
Oh, hey, buddy.
But not with, you know,
whoa,
wife.
How?
Hey, shoot the messenger.
Huh? Let's do a double edition of the short order news. You want to? Is there anything you want to cover before we go? We have like we're out of time. The
like to cover that spot on your jeans.
What?
Hey, don't. Now you look.
Oh, you got me. That's hilarious for a 7-year-old. Yeah. Hey,
what?
Huh? Here's a double dose of Mark Maron's short order news so you're informed and know what's happening and blah, blah. There's the music. White House senior advisor Karl Rove has been told by special counsel Patrick Fitzgerald that he will not be charged in the CIA leak case. With the announcement of this incredible news, Bush's approval rating is expected to skyrocket to the high 20s. Well, it looks like President Bush will be coming back from Baghdad after all. You see, no meta. FBI statistics confirm this week that violent crime in the U.S. is on the rise, posting its biggest one-year increase since 1991. This is bad news for anyone who lives in these cities, but great news for fans of the ever-expanding CSI television franchise. New plot lines. Nationally, murders rose 4.8%, the most since 1998, and the largest percentage increase in 15 years. Bush administration officials are concerned that there may be no way to somehow blame this on Bill Clinton. Coincidentally, violent crime committed by Americans in the rest of the world is on the rise as well. You know, there's an argument to be had about having people laugh at these jokes. And we've covered this before.
Maybe we should have a laugh track.
This isn't meta, by the way. This is a conversation.
Can we have a laugh? Why don't we try a laugh track one day?
Because that would be I want people to understand that you hide. You're a laugh suppressor.
That'd
like
be
a
funny.
Lot of people think that why isn't Jim laughing? No, you laugh. You're like, and you kind of you don't like You kind of like it's a
okay,
little hissy.
Because it sounds fake when it comes out of me. I just want one more joke.
This is not meta. This is a conversation. A California man downed 47 grilled cheese sandwiches in 10 minutes this weekend in Las Vegas has set a world record. With this latest victory, Joey Chestnut is expected to be a shoe-in on the competitive diarrhea circuit. Yeah, okay, Bill and Andy, thank you very much. But when you just push the mic button and then stop it before the laugh finishes, then it's awkward. Like, if you left the mics open, you know what I mean? It's like it sounded like this.
See, this is the way I would have laughed at that.
All right, well, I'll do another one. There's a double dose here. I'll do the whole setup again. This is not meta. This is a conversation being had during a bit. A California man downed 47 grilled cheese sandwiches in 10 minutes this weekend in Las Vegas to set a world record. Chestnut ate 47 grilled cheese sandwiches in Vegas, then he blew it all at the tables. Well, not all of it. Somebody blew on the floor and the tiles in the bathroom. That's awful. That's awful.
See, that's how I laugh. Don't blame me. Look, I can't help it.
It's a conversation to be had. Sam Cedar's going to be... What?
Say laugh track. Laugh track.
What do you mean a laugh track? That would sound like we're mocking it.
No. You know what? It brings attention to the joke. Let's try a laugh track. If everybody knows it's a laugh track, why not?
I don't know, man.
Can't hurt.
That's sweetening.
One day.
I'm against sweetening.
One day. It's not sweetening if you admit it.
We can splend it. Sam Cedar's going to be here tomorrow. Marjorie Cohn on Gitmo and Aaron Watata and Ethan Smith on the Dixie Chicks. Actually, Angus, too. Good night, Sheeple.